ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
यदा शरणं
आत्मानं
ऐक्षता
श्रान्ता
वाजिनम्
अस्त्रम्
ब्रह्मा
शिरो
मेने
आत्मा
त्राणम्
द्विजात्मजः
यदा शरणं
आत्मानम्
ऐक्षत श्रान्तवाजिनम्
अश्रं ब्रह्म
शिरोमेने
आत्मत्राणं
द्विजात्मजः
यदा शरणं
आत्मानम्
ऐक्षत श्रान्तवाजिनम्
अस्त्रं ब्रह्म
शिरोमेने
आत्मत्राणं
द्विजात्मजः
यदा
शरणमात्मानम्
ऐक्षत
श्रान्तवाजिनम्
अस्त्रं
ब्रह्म
शिरोमेने
आत्मत्राणं
द्विजात्मजः
Yada,
when
asharanam,
without being alternatively protected,
atmanam,
his own self,
aikshata,
sa,
shranta,
vajinam,
the horses being tired.
Astram,
weapon.
Brahmashira,
the topmost or ultimate nuclear.
Mene,
applied.
Atmatranam,
just to save himself.
Dvija
Atmaja,
the son of a Brahmana.
When the son of the Brahmana Ashwatthama, saw that his horses were tired, he considered that there was no alternative for protection outside of his using the ultimate weapon, the Brahmastra, nuclear weapon. Purport. In the ultimate issue only, when there is no alternative, the nuclear weapon called the Brahmastra is applied. The word Dvijatmaja is significant because here Ashwatthama, although the son of Dronacharya, was not exactly a qualified Brahmana. The most intelligent man is called a Brahmana and is not a hereditary title. Ashwatthama was also formally called the Brahma Bandhu, or the friend of a Brahma. Being a friend of a Brahman does not mean that one is a Brahman by qualification. A friend or son of a Brahman, when fully qualified, can be called a Brahmana and not otherwise. Since Ashwatthama's decision is immature, he is purposely called herein the son of a Brahmana. So here we're in narration of the activities of the appearance of Maharaj Parikshit. Because without him appearing, then you won't have the discussion of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Right? That's been the question before that the sages were making. Is they want to know what is this Bhagavatam and how it came about. So it's been described as being the narration of the Supreme Lord. And it's coming about is because Parikshit Maharaj has heard it from Sukadev Goswami. So then to understand this, then we understand the appearance of Maharaj Parikshit and all that surrounds that. So the glory of his appearance then is the Lord. Because the Lord protected him personally, then he is special. And being protected, he acknowledged that position of the Lord, that special position. So therefore, he was always trying to find that person. Therefore, he's known as Parikshit. Parikshit means the examiner, who would check everything. Because everybody he would see, he'd go up close and look at them to see, is this the person that I saw that protected me while I was in the womb? So that element then becomes... That element... I move it away because it's too loud. You see, there's a phenomenon. This thing was designed in the West, right? And in the West, there's a concept amongst acoustic experts that echo within a room should not be heard coming from the mic. Though in India, it is the most popular element. If it doesn't distort, if it doesn't echo, if it doesn't disturb your life airs, it's not loud enough, right? I repeat, it's not loud enough. So therefore, you make it, it's too loud, I move it away, because it goes down in sound to what would be called a balanced sound by sound technicians. Then you turn it up again so you get the perfect Indian echo and distortion. Right? So that's unnecessary. You know, that's all. The point is that people can hear. It's not that it reverberates and, you know, like that kind of thing. That's not the important element. Right? Because if we're playing, what is it? Is that called handball or something, or lacrosse or something? Then you want to bounce it off the walls and you get more points. The more it bounces, the more points you get. But in this, no. Okay? Yeah. So then, that's what's special about Parikshit Maharaj, is his birth and his hearing Srimad Bhagavatam and his death. In between, he was a great king. We hear other things about him, how he protected the earth from Kaliraj. These elements then were heard. So then, to actually appreciate, because it's like this, it's just like, you say, somebody's there. Someone's intelligent. They're dynamic. They can do so many things. But unless somehow or another they've been socially accepted as popular, then the common people will not notice. It's just the way it is, because the common person tends to be a little, self-absorbed, so they don't notice what's going on around them. But if other people say someone's great, then people accept it. They themselves don't know. They may have a standard, they may not. Or they may think, it's something interesting, but they wouldn't want to be the odd man out to say, hey, this person's nice, when everybody else says they're not. Right? No one wants to take that position. Right? I think it was Groucho Marx who made the point. He says, one man in 1,000 is a leader of men. Right? The other 999 are followers of women. Right? So the point is very few want to stand out, and despite what people might think, they're not willing to do the needful or to do something different to get done what needs to get done or to lead, because they're worried that someone may think, oh, it's not nice, it's not good, what will they say, what if this one says this? But that's not the point. The leader means who does despite. But for the common person, then either the activities have to be so amazing that everybody starts talking about them because they're in the news, everyone talks and everyone wants to know, you want to know what's this, what's that, what's going on, what's special. Or, if not, then someone has to say it, right? So if it's expressed that this person is special, nice, wonderful, then people start to notice, oh, maybe he is, yeah, okay. Because someone said, then it's all right if you follow that. Does that make sense? Because if someone else is doing it, and you do it, then you're not the only idiot, right? That's the main point, is no one wants to be the idiot. Right? Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur tells that story of the circus. Right? The best I've heard narration is by Bhakti Churumar. She tells it very nicely. But in essence, the circus came to town. It was set up, huge circus. It took, normally they'll set up a circus in a day or two, right? You don't want to lose time and money, right? Because this circus took months to set up. Bigger and bigger tents, more and more amazing, so many little details, just a complete phantasmagoria. No one could figure out, what is this? Then finally, the day comes to open, everybody now wants to know, what is this? So they all go to see, and they all come crowding in. And then the ticket man at the ticket desk says, there's a special rule in this circus, it's not like any other circus, everybody's going to go in one at a time. Right? You're not going to go in together, only one at a time. So if you all make a nice line from there, so they get in line. And then the man who was at the front thought, oh, I'm so fortunate because I'll get to go in first. Right? I don't have to wait like everybody else. So then he pays his money. He goes inside the tent, the huge circus tent. He goes inside. There's absolutely nothing inside. Completely empty. Nothing. And then he looks around, and then standing in the middle, he sees this monster giant. And he wonders, well, I guess maybe this is the show or something. So he goes over close to see what is going on, this giant. And this giant grabs it, and then takes a stick and starts beating him and beating him and beating him like anything. And then after beating him so much he can't tolerate it anymore, then the giant brings him to the door, grabs him by the scruff of the neck, throws him out. Says, now get out of here. And then he's come out. And when he comes out, then everybody goes, wow, how was it? Because he was the first one in. Now, if he tells everybody, well, there's a big giant in there, you go in, you get beat and everything, then he'll be the idiot. Right? No one wants to be the idiot. So then he says, oh, it's great, it's wonderful, yeah, such a show, so nice, so fabulous, like this. And then he runs off. And then the next person with the big smile on the face goes in, gets beaten, same treatment, gets thrown out. Now he comes out and everyone goes, how was it? Now he can't say, I got beaten, because the first guy said it was great, so maybe he saw something great and I'm the idiot because I got beaten. So then he says, yeah, wonderful, great, fabulous show. And like this, every single person in the line got beaten like this. So this is the material world, right? So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur then, in describing this, because it's his story, then he says that this is the material world and that everybody goes through it, right? Each succeeding generation. The first generation says, it's wonderful. And then the next generation, not to be considered a fool, then they also then take it up, like, you know, Prabhupada explains, new crows, very enthusiastic. They dive into the garbage pile and picking through and everything's treasure, right? And so then they, like this, and then each generation tells the next it's fabulous. Even though they had a miserable time, it was terrible, there was nothing for them, but they tell the next generation, great, fabulous. So that's the material world. Is that if everybody says it's fabulous, everybody will say it's fabulous. Otherwise, you're the idiot. Right? If you say, hey, this is not. Right? In the Western, you have the emperor's new clothes. Right? Everybody from top down is saying, great clothes. And one kid says, hey, the king's got nothing on. And then everybody goes, oh, he's right. You know? But they all knew it, but they didn't want to say it because they all went along with it. So that's actual society. Right? That's mundane society. That's why Lord Chaitanya tells Raghunath Das, don't get caught up in this regular social discussions, gramya katha. Because that's all it is. It's just the talk of people who are the 999. They have nothing else to do. All they can do is try to socially fit in and not be the idiot and not be the stupid one. You know? And so therefore then this is the reality. And the rare person who will say, no, it's like this, or it's like that. So that is the Brahminical culture. Brahminical culture is one who says what is true and what's false is false. That's real. And basically everyone else follows. The religious kings, the righteous kings, they also then follow in this truth. And others, the common person, just follows. So here, to point out that Parikit is something special, then here it's being pointed out. And if he just says, yeah, he had this, you know, far out birth, the Lord saved him, and then he went on, and then, you know, he did a few nice things, and then, you know, he heard, you know, sat down, gave up everything, and sat down on the bank of the Ganga, fasted for 7 days, and, you know, heard some Srimad Bhagavatam, and then got bit by a snake, and, you know, went up in a puff of smoke, and Hari Bol, you know. Then it's like, who cares? So this whole introduction has to be made to show how special it is. How special it is that the Lord came. What is the situation? What is going on? This is nothing ordinary. Right? He's not some guy that's being attacked. They're in their house and a bunch of dacoits come in. And, no. He's being attacked by a brahmastra. The ultimate weapon in the universe. Right? It's being launched by Ashwatthama. He's being protected by the Supreme Lord himself personally. After his mother has gone to the Supreme Lord and offered prayers. Right? We got to remember this girl is 12. Right? And so all this is going on. So then you start to see, wow, hey, this is a far out God. So now if he's so far out, he's done all this, then what he's listening to for 7 days, that if I sit down and read it, it's going to take me years to read, then it's worthwhile. Right? Because no one wants to be the idiot. No one wants to be reading that book that everybody else thinks is stupid. Right? You want to be reading the book that everybody else thinks is nice. So then they have to show who is thinking it's nice, why it's nice, what's going on, everything like that. So then we have these things here. Then to bring this out, to bring out the drama, to bring out the attraction, then you have Ashwatthama here. He is referred to here as the son of a Brahmana, right? Dvijatmaja. Is that being the son of a Brahmana doesn't automatically make him a Brahmana. He has the best chance to become one, right? Because association is one quarter of the cause of your inherent nature. So by being born in a Brahmin family, then it's so much easier because of the association. Means the parents are performing all brahminical activities, the father's occupation is brahminical, the discussion will be brahminical, the food, the nature, the interaction, the lifestyle, everything will be brahminical. So without even consideration, the child will grow up like that. It will be very, very nice for them. Very easily, they will become brahminical. And if they're not, then that doesn't matter. Because by having that inherent nature, and by taking up the activities of hearing and chanting about the Lord, then the brahminical culture will naturally develop. But here, he's born so, but it's not automatic, you know, that one born in the Brahmin family will take up the brahminical culture. So what's being mentioned here is that even though he's born in the family of a Brahmin, he is more worried about his own self, he's more worried about the various situations that are not according to the religious principles. Right? It means that if the religious principles aren't nicely put in order according to time, place, and circumstance, then there's something less, something lacking. So that's what happened here, is that there is something lacking. He's immature. Right? He's decided to use the Brahmastra, the ultimate weapon, when ultimate weapons could be used. He was on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. He defeated many people. He never used the Brahmastra. Now he's decided to use the Brahmastra. Even more immature is, even he's decided to use the Brahmastra, okay, you want to use the Brahmastra, you have a formidable enemy who has celestial weapons, you know he's a little bit annoyed because he just slaughtered his five children, you know, and he's coming, you know, he's just loaded his chariot with all the, you know, most fierce weapons, and he's coming at you with a very ferocious mood, and his horses are fresh, yours are tired. Okay, naturally, it's time to become a little worried. But that doesn't necessarily mean the Brahmastra is there. Or if he's using it, then he has to know what to do with it. Ashwatthama only knows how to release it. He doesn't know how to retract it. So that's very immature. One, he doesn't have enough knowledge. Two, is even if he does release it, okay, he saves himself from Arjuna. Because he turns Arjuna into a little pile of ashes. But the problem is if you don't know how to withdraw the Brahmastra, then it will turn the rest of the universe into ashes, including himself. So that's what we call in, you know, kind of Western terminology, out of the frying pan into the fire, right? And this is like out of the frying pan into the nuclear, how do you say? Was it the reaction? So it goes. So it's not mature. It's not well thought out plan. So therefore, because of that, he's not using intelligence. Therefore, he's known as the son of a Brahmin. Son of a Brahmin means he's respected. He'll be given respect of a Brahmin, but you may not take him so seriously when it comes to surrendering. Right? As we discussed before, Manu mentions someone who is dressed as a Brahmin. He will be, and claims to be one, he will be dealt with as if he is. It means socially. It means you'll be respectful towards him. You might, you know, give him something to eat. You might even give him some charity. But it's understood that your charity and what you offer will only give you double the result as if you had given it to, you know, some poor beggar or something like that. An ordinary person. While giving it to a qualified Brahmin, you get 100,000 times return, right? So it's not a great investment, right? You ask any businessman, okay, you take your capital investment, and you have two options. You can put it into a investment that will get you 100% profit, right? Sounds pretty good, okay? Or you can put it into something that's going to get you 100,000 times profit. Right? Which are they going to take? Right? So, that's the point. It's still not a loss. But you wouldn't invite them to perform your yajna. You wouldn't hear from them the philosophy. You wouldn't have them, you know, take up the position of anything special rituals or special respect or like that, because they're not a Brahmin. In this case, they're born in the Brahmin family, so a son of a Brahmin, or they just claim to be, so then that's another thing. But in any case, in the Vedic culture, that's respected, right? Very different from the Western culture, where someone may be in the position able to do characters that are weak. So then everything goes, right? Person is prime minister of a country, does something wrong, everything down to the root is disregarded, right? And if he's done something nice once, then they're the world superstar, superhero. They sing one song that everybody likes immediately in one day. They're famous all over the world. And then they write a song that nobody likes. You're still listening to that guy? You know, it's like their history. Right? So Vedic culture, you know, is designed so that the melodramatic soap opera aspect is controlled. So the ups and downs in the society aren't too much. It's enough to create interest, but not enough to be insane. Right? Therefore, he's son of a Brahmin. He's still respected as the son of a Brahmin, with potential to become one. Right? Even he's done this, which is not considered good, then we have to remember is that in the future, then he will be redeemed. And he will be given all respect. Because the material world is temporary. Therefore, any good act and any bad act is temporary. The idea of eternal damnation is for fools. That's for idiots. That's for socially shallow and inept people who themselves, the only way they can maintain their character is if anybody who does something wrong is absolutely destroyed, then they will consider, okay, maybe I should toe the line. That's what eternal damnation is for, that caliber of person. The person at the drop of a hat might be doing the sinfulest thing. But the only reason he doesn't do it is because he's got a little more sensitivity, is worried about the reaction. And because it's so heavy and everybody says it's bad, he doesn't do it. Otherwise he would. Right? Kamsa. He would have killed his sister. Would have. On the spot. As soon as he found out she's pregnant with the 9th child. Right? Because that's our 8th child. That's the one. But he thought, socially I'll be finished because one is, she's a woman. Two, she's under my care. You know, under my protection in my prison. Right? Giving her shelter. Three, she's my sister. That'll look really bad. And four, on top of all that, she's pregnant. Add that all up, bad news. Right? Even the other demons will think he's bad. Right? Like here, Duryodhana. He's the demon in this story. Right? But he feels it's bad that Ashwatthama killed the 5 sons of Draupadi. He didn't like the Pandavas, but he liked the Kuru dynasty. Right? So if the Pandavas' children are killed, there is no Kuru dynasty. Right? He doesn't know about Parikshit. So as far as he's concerned, he's killed, all his sons are killed, all his brothers are killed, all their sons are killed. The only ones left of the Kuru dynasty are the five sons of Draupadi. So naturally now, whatever it is, he's wiped them out, they've wiped him out, okay, fair is fair. But the Kurus should still be the leaders of the world. Why it should go to another dynasty? Right? Because that's it, because you want to be part of something that lasts. No one wants to be part of, you know, something that didn't last. So therefore he's upset. It's foolish. There's no need. So even the demons will think that there is even a line there. They will even think it's bad. Right? They'll even, the grossest materialists will say, have a standard. So this is, yeah. So one has to be careful is that this is not one's motivation. Or the opposite, that you are good by nature and you're so proud of it that anyone who's not up to your standard is a write-off. Right? These are basically our alternatives. But Krishna consciousness is in the middle. Right? Like we see here, the Bhagavatam doesn't get too much into the detail on this side, this way, that way. It brings out what's the important elements of the story, the important elements of the rasa, in a very nice way so that you appreciate the interaction between the Lord and the devotees. Right? That's the thing. Krishna's involved in this pastime. He's going to work out how Ashutama has to be simultaneously killed to please Bhima, and at the same time not killed to please Draupadi. And he's going to save Parikkit, which he's personally involved in. Right? He's already going to personally have trained Sukadeva Goswami to come out of the room to speak this Bhagavatam so that this whole thing can come take place. So all these are nice arrangements by the Lord interacting with his devotees. That's the thing to gain. Because the Paramahamsas will make the distinction in rasa like that. In the material world, we have a tendency to not make distinctions so much. Right? It's sensual, it's emotional, it's spiritual. It's there. But the main thing is that it has to distinguish that there is material emotion that is very powerful, very absorbing, very inspirational, right? But at the same time, is if that gets in the way of the spiritual, then it has no meaning. That distinction has to be made. So that is what the Bhagavatam is pointing out, because the Mahabharata doesn't really make the distinction. Very emotional, very powerful, doesn't make the distinction. Ramayana, it's all about the Lord, so you don't have to make the distinction. So the simple person can read that, be absorbed in the Lord, without knowing really what's going on. Mahabharata, then there's scenes with the Lord, scenes without the Lord, all emotionally powerful. How do you distinguish? One is Dharma, one's Sanatan Dharma. One is religious principles being done. One is being done in connection with the Lord. Right? Duryodhana is performing religious principles. Pandavas are doing it in relationship to the Lord. So there's a difference. So that's why then the Bhagavatam is higher, because then it's all for Paramahamsas. It's actually being discussed for the transcendental platform. So then ultimately, then it has to be brought to the platform that whatever the qualification, whatever the background, whether it's pious or not pious, then the point is to become qualified by following the order of Guru. By following the order of Guru, sticking to the order of Guru to please the Lord, then one becomes qualified, one becomes that actual Brahman, one who knows Brahman. And one who knows that Brahman is Krishna, that is Vaishnava. Right? And one who knows that Lord is Krishna is a Karshana. And one who serves Krishna as a servant in the mood of full surrender, or Srimati Radharani, is a Gaudiya. Right? So these are the natural progression. Is that you have to know Brahman. Brahman means that's what is prominent for you. Everybody knows it's there. Okay, everybody knows, okay, we're not the body. But is that the foundation of your varna and ashram? If it is, then you're a Brahman. Whatever occupation you're performing. And if it's not, even though you're performing the Brahminical duties, then technically you're just a friend of a Brahman or son of a Brahman. This is the point. Does that make sense? The subtle point is that it's actually the consciousness that's important. The activity is in support of the consciousness. Depending upon your consciousness, you're going to perform an activity. So the consciousness is most important. Even if you're pouring the right activity, the bad consciousness, that's not the ideal. But if you're performing a activity that may not be considered the best, but the consciousness is perfect, that's considered better. Right? But at the same time, is society has to have a form. It has to have a structure. Therefore, then you'll say, this activity is better than that, this one's better than that. So you'll create a whole good and bad. Otherwise, if you can't create that, then how, without discrimination, how you decide that spiritual is good, material is bad? Right? It's the same principle. So structure must be there. There must be a form. Okay, Brahman is higher than Kshatriya, Sannyas is higher than Vanaprastha. You know, knowledge is better than sense gratification. Control of the senses is better than engaging the sense. All these different things are there. But at the same time, is the point is to get to what is the ultimate consciousness. Because in that, this is better than that, and pure consciousness is considered the best. That's the ultimate. Right? But at the same time, because those who are honest and that ultimate Krishna consciousness is their perfect motive, then whatever they do will be perfect. Because that's their consciousness. What they do will be perfect. But someone who that's not their thrust may use this aspect of our philosophy wrong. Right? So they'll say it's the consciousness that counts, even though they're doing activities that are not good. Right? So to correct that, then you lean back on the form. Since you didn't catch actually the principle anyway, therefore, you have to see the externals of what you're doing is right. Does that make sense? The subtle creates the gross. But if your subtle is wrong, your gross is going to be automatically wrong. So, since they can't catch the subtle, first at least make the gross right. And then from the gross being right, you can point out that the subtle should look like this. Does that make sense? That's the idea. Is the person is doing nonsense, you get them to stop doing nonsense and get them to do something that's good. Then from doing good, you try to get them into proper consciousness. That's the method. The easiest, direct, is just change the consciousness. Everything else will follow, it doesn't matter. But if you can't just immediately change the consciousness, then you change the activities. That are in line with what that person of changed consciousness would do. Then by doing that, then with time, consciousness will change. Does that make some sense? So then in here, that's the point, is that if the activity is wrong, consciousness is wrong, then it's not good. Right? Activity is right, consciousness is wrong, it's better, but it's not ideal. Right? Consciousness is right, activity is not ideal, that's emergency situation. Consciousness is right, activity is right, that's ideal. Any questions on this? Yes, sir. In? Oh, what are the ingredients? Okay, what are the elements of consciousness? The basic elements, the building block, fundamental building block of consciousness is two things. Is what your identity is, and then what the goal or what you can gain from that identity. That is the ultimate building blocks of consciousness, all the levels of consciousness. Now, depending upon those two, you will accept, means if one's intelligent, one will accept a form of activity that matches the identity and is the efficiently gets you your goal. Does that make sense? So the first thing, that's the next step you look at. The first thing you look at is those two. Is the identity and the goal of that identity. So basically there's two choices, two groups of choices, main fundamental blocks you can run from. One is, I am the controller, I am the enjoyer. So my identity is I'm the controller, and the goal of that control is I am the enjoyer. I gain, and from that gain I enjoy. So therefore, then the activities will be material that I will enjoy in this way. So I'll endeavor for this particular kind of enjoyment. Right? So then this is where you get into detail, because you could endeavor for personal sensual enjoyment, you can endeavor for extended sensual enjoyment, you can endeavor for, pious activities, emotional activities that will get you a pious result, a prosperous result. You could endeavor for intellectual upliftment that will get you Brahman realization. Right? So all those four will fit into that category of the controller and enjoyer. Right? And then within that, you can break that all down, those four down into Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyasa, and Brahmacharya. These are all identities that you can have, and you want to enjoy the fruits of being a Brahmacharya, the fruits of a Grihastha, or the fruits of a Kshatriya, or the fruits of a Brahman, like that. So therefore, you will choose those activities. So it just gets finer and finer. The other side, then, the other alternative is, I am servant of Krishna, and Krishna's enjoyment is my goal. In other words, love for Krishna, and expressing it through pleasing Him is the goal. So that will then create spiritual activity, or devotional activity. That can fall into various realms of formal and informal, or Vaikuntha or Vrindavan, and that can fall into, then depending upon the realm, into five rasas. Like that. Which, in which you have an identity that you can express to that love for Krishna. Another, like that. In other words, one is your own inherent for yourself, and the other is for others. You want to please Krishna, you want to be Krishna. So that's basically what consciousness is made out of. Then everything else is in fine detail. So that's why so much technical, metaphysical detail is explained about the levels of consciousness, the mind, how it works, the intelligence, the ego, how it works, the varnashram system, the various aspects and elements of that, so that one can nail down specifically one's own conditioned identity and figure out how to now reverse the process. Now, I'm the controller and I'm the enjoyer, but now if I control for Krishna and results of what I would normally want to enjoy I give it to Krishna, then I reverse the process. Though it hasn't come, it's still dovetailed, but it's in the fire. So it's as good as rock. It's good as fire. Because now I'm using what previously was my material identity to enjoy myself, acquire my own prestige and facility, my own gain and safety. Now I use that for Krishna. Then that becomes our means of elevation. Otherwise it becomes our means of degradation. Degradation here meaning staying in the material world, and elevation meaning getting out of the material world. Because otherwise, within material, there's always up and down. You know, you can go to the heavenly planets, you can become Brahma, you can become great yogis and sages, or you might become, you know, these Hindu gopacher, you know, like this one thing. But well, here we're taking the definition of being in the material world, that's considered degraded. And being going back to Godhead, that's considered good, the transcendent, elevated. So anything in the material world or the concept of I'm being out of the material world is my happiness and liberation, all that's considered within the material sphere. Does that make sense? And everything else is detailed, just so anyone can understand where it is that your identity lies most. Because within the identity, there's there's five aspects, means four aspects of false identity. The root is what I just mentioned about control and enjoyer. After that, then you get three others, expand from there. What it is, what your physical identity is, your body, the community, your body, the gender, the community, the nation, you know, like this.
Then
that aspect, that's one, your social strata and all that. So that comes from the false ego. Then from the intelligence, then it's how smart you feel you are and how good you feel you are with your senses. The senses and intelligence are connected like that, because refined senses means refined intelligence. You can discriminate between, you know, fine tastes or fine sounds or fine smells or fine touches or fine what you can see like that. So then that takes intelligence to discriminate. So the two go together. Many times my very intellectual people are also very sensual, though maybe it's a refined sensuality, but sensual nonetheless. You know, they want fine music or fine food or fine surroundings, fine clothes, fine, you know, association, fine engagements, fine things like this. So it's, so they're very concerned about it, but it's in a refined way. They don't identify in any way with the gross person, so don't make it, because they're less intelligent. They don't make distinction. Then the third of it will be the emotional platform, how you identify your value system. What you are, what is it you do, what you work for, what your ideals are, your goals, and how you mold your life, and what's important for you emotionally, like that. So that can be either very refined and elevated, you work for others, you work for liberation, or you work for, you know, your family and community, or the lowest is you just work for yourself. What gets, what makes you happy, you just do it. You go over there, you blow this guy away, you take his stuff, you enjoy it. You're happy because that's your value system. So that comes from the mind, like that. So the trick is if you can change the mind, you change the whole thing, like that. It means all the other three: the intelligence and the ego. So because the mind is, it's a very unique thing in that it works on experience. It doesn't work on intelligence. That's the great thing about it, you know, is that from all indications, what you want to do shouldn't be done, but because it means something to you, you do it anyway. And then afterwards, you kick yourself because you knew you shouldn't have done it and you got a bad result, but you couldn't help yourself because it's your value. So that's the point, is mind has nothing to do with intelligence. That's why when someone gets emotional, there is no intelligence. Right. So, therefore, the intelligent person bases his emotions on already set standards that are good. So, therefore, when they become emotional, they don't have to worry about what they're doing is proper, because they can't discriminate when they're in there. So, they've already had a value that what I will do is proper. So, therefore, then they'll go fall back to the intelligence, that they've already planned what is good and what is not, by the results that they get, right? And depending on what they want, if the results are sense gratification, they'll choose all those. They'll only order what is good to eat. They'll only buy what is good to eat. They'll only accept what is good to eat, right? Out of some sentiment they won't accept, because they don't want to not enjoy something, right? So, you know, like that. So then, but they've already decided that there's something higher, or whatever it is, whatever is their value, or it's a social thing, pleasing the other person. They've offered me something that I never would eat, but because they've offered it with such affection, I'll eat it, because more important is that emotional exchange rather than the sensual. You know, or what they're offering to eat, it doesn't matter my senses, it doesn't matter their emotions, if it's going to go against my Krishna consciousness or my liberating myself from the material world, I'm not going to eat it, I'm not going to accept it. Even though with great affection they offer something that we can't accept as devotees, we won't take it. Right? And then depending upon whether whether we are what's important for us is what's important, or the social structure, or pleasing Guru and Krishna, or these, then our reaction to that person will vary. So we pick the path of liberation there. So we won't accept something lower. So on that platform, it's higher. But because we're not socially, let's say, refined, therefore we may say something really strong and react very heavily to the person. That, what's this? Yeah, it's as crazy as nobody can. It's like this, when they meant it in all good, way. So if there's some refinement, then you'll understand, thank you very much, this, that, so considerate. But, we have these things, we can't accept this, so you'll have to excuse me and this and that. But if you offer something else, or I can accept this, like this. You want to please them, but not compromise yourself. Or you just get your work done, and it doesn't matter if the guy gets, upset or disturbed or that. So these are all the refined details in consciousness. So that's why if a higher one is there, then that's given credence. But then the problem is it shouldn't stay like that. That's why etiquette is brought in, but etiquette's the mind. So it's, on one sense, the unreasonable part, but if it's the culture of Krishna consciousness, it doesn't need reason, because its rasa is to please Guru, Krishna, and the Vaishnavas. Therefore, following the Vaishnava etiquette and culture pleases everybody. But that value has to be taken, so that means that identity has to be accepted. Then it'll start to work. So that's why you'll see devotees may be very strict and just completely, all it is what Prabhupada says, what he's in his books, what they're told to do, we're perfectly according to authority. But socially, they may be the most difficult person to deal with. But on one standard, they're perfectly situated in one way. It's because they'll never do anything that is not according to the rules and regulations of Krishna consciousness. But at the same time, it's because those rules and regulations are there for your interaction between Guru, Krishna, and the Vaishnavas. Therefore, it's weak in that you still think you're the controller. You may be submissive to the controllers above you, but anything that you consider that's below you, you have no consideration for. So therefore, then you'll be socially inept. You'll be a rough person, you'll be difficult, no one can work with you, it's that. On that side, that can tell, or it can be emotionally just accepted, and you can't make distinction between higher and lower, or emergency and regular, and so emotionally you're completely fixed, you'll be a fanatic. In either one, they're both fanatics. Just one's an emotional fanatic, and one's an intellectual, So one's the nerd, and one's the sentimentalist. Or they go even further. They get so much in the mode of goodness that then they lose it that way. It gets too academic. So in any case, then identity that's actually what all this technical metaphysical things are, is simply to get us to understand what is the conditioned nature, and so that we can identify it and engage it in Krishna's service, and therefore dissolve it and go back to Godhead. Because that's all it is. If we can get the mind to accept this moment that pure love for Krishna and pleasing Krishna is, in the association of the devotees is the only thing we want, and we immediately surrender to that, our work's done. That's it. There's nothing more than that needed. That it's that simple. But the problem is to convince the mind of that, then takes so much study, so much association, so much activity, so much, your sadhana, all these different things to slowly, chip away at what the mind accepted as the identity and feels is our actual source of benefit. Yes.
Yeah. Throughout the day, the consciousness changes, doesn't fluctuate, doesn't sit, either I'm serving
reduce the roller coaster, like that. Some say roller coasters are very good. But others opine that something a little bit more, you know, they're great, but if you want to have lunch, try having lunch on a roller coaster. Try taking your bath on a roller coaster or a nap. Talking to friends, you know. Hi, how are you? So it's like, it has its place, but it's... So then... Yes, so then that's the... Now, in applying this, then the consciousness will go up and down. And it will both go back and forth from spiritual to material. And within those two, you'll have ups and downs depending upon whether the ego aspect of the false ego, false identity, you know, the consciousness is up or down, or the intellectual aspect and sensual is up or down, or the emotional aspect is up or down. So, you know, to add to the fun, it's not just switching back and forth between spiritual and material, it's the mix within that. Is that even though it's in the spiritual, but you may be running within lower grade or higher grade mundane identity. So therefore, your performance of your service may be pleasing to others and it may completely annoy them. You know, like that. You know, or you annoy yourself, or, you know, something happens. So that's the thing. Because there's, you know, does that make some sense? Like that. So then, yeah, no, generally it's always someone else annoys us. You know, somehow or another it always comes back to that. We're fine. You know, we're no flies on Jack, right? You know, everybody else has got something. That. So then, so this is the principle of anartha nivritti. Means bhajana kriya is taken up so that you're performing activities that are transcendental, purely transcendental, like chanting Hare Krishna, hearing Bhagavatam, associating with devotees, worshipping the deity, living in the Dham. These are directly transcendental. Then you have all kinds of activities that support these activities. So that by performance of those, they will give you the best opportunity to make that Krishna conscious choice to keep yourself in transcendental consciousness. At the same time as they also start to purify the anarthas that make up the body of our mundane identity. So then by dealing with them and by engaging in the Lord's service, then we're purified. By engaging in the Lord's service with knowledge of what's going on, then we start to identify that it's not actually the activity, it's the consciousness of the activity that's nice. Like there may have been times where, let's say we were doing an activity, you know, a devotional activity, and it went perfectly according to the letter. But maybe our consciousness was distracted. Well, another time we were very focused, very Krishna conscious, but externally nothing was really going right. And if you think back, those are the moments you remember. You know, it's those moments of when you're Krishna conscious. Then you attribute that to the activity. That's the mind. The mind will say it was the activity. Actually, it's the consciousness. But because the activity was done for the purpose of Krishna consciousness, we don't need to separate it too much. Only ultimately, if we get to the point where the activity becomes prominent, because there's always the thing is that, therefore, I had the various taste in that activity, and I'm not identifying so as the consciousness is best. So I keep doing that activity, but maybe my consciousness goes down because the activity wasn't so good that I feel I didn't get the taste I got at that time because it's not so perfect, so I'll perfect the activity. I get so absorbed in perfecting the activity, I miss that I'm doing it to please Krishna. So then we become distracted. So we perfect the activity, but then there's no taste. So then, if we don't have knowledge, then here is a very dangerous situation, which many devotees have faced and do face, is then they decide that activity that previously they identified as Krishna consciousness, but they're performing it not necessarily in Krishna consciousness. They're performing it to perfect the activity. It's not giving the taste because now they're getting mundane consciousness and the reaction of that. So then the mind rejects it and they drop. that either that activity of Krishna consciousness, or if there's enough of those, or that one is powerful enough, they'll drop Krishna consciousness. That's going on daily in our society. Because the discrimination is not mentioned. That's why Bhuti Yoga. Bhuti Yoga means performing the activities of Nishkam Karma Yoga with intelligence. That's Bhuti Yoga. And that Nishkam Karma Yoga is being done to please Krishna, therefore it's called Bhakti. So when bhakti is there, when you're performing the activities in Nishkam Karma Yoga with intelligence to please Krishna, that's Bhuti Yoga. So that's what the Gita talks about. Like that. If it's just on its own, it's just Nishkam Karma. You're performing it without the desire for the fruit. That will elevate you. Anybody does it. The nonsense karmi rascal does something good for someone else without a desire for the result. He's elevated to some degree. It will go in his credit book for some pious result, like that. But there's no knowledge. Or the Hindu is performing the activity, do your duty, be detached, this and that. They say all these things, but it doesn't mean anything to them. So it's just Nishkam Karma. But when it's connected to the Lord, there's Nishkam Karma Yoga. Right? And of yoga is Bhakti Yoga. And because they do it with knowledge, they know what's going on, what's happening in the process, at least in principle. Then it becomes Bhuti Yoga. So that becomes the ideal. Then if that is there, then you'll start to identify as, in the beginning, all these ups and downs, you start to analyze it. So you start to reflect within the heart the worthiness or worthlessness of any activity or any desire. So in the beginning, even a worthless thing because of our attachment will be okay. But with time, you know it's not okay, but you can't not do it. Because it's still habit, and it's just still so entrenched. But if that's kept up, one is persistent, then with time, then that will, the benefits that you gain from it, so-called benefits, aren't enough to outweigh the loss. And so then you start to see, I don't actually get any benefit from this. And it doesn't help my Krishna consciousness, I don't even get material benefit from it. So most of it is just dropped. It just fades away. But there has to be that focus on it to get it to fade away. Who will make it fade away is Krishna. Then the modes of nature, then just by dealing with them in the mode of goodness, they will reduce passion, ignorance will go. Therefore, the desire for it, or the hankering for it, will go away. You know, the endeavor in sense gratification, the desire for it will go if you perform the mode of goodness, because it will bring you to goodness, it will liberate you. The modes do that. But to actually make the choice that I want to move in that direction, to please Krishna, that's coming from bhakti. That we receive from the devotees. Then bhakti gives bhakti. So any devotee activity done in bhakti will create the desire to do it again. You already retained what you've done, and you have the desire to do it again. So you're already at a plus. And then if you do it again, now you have double. And because you've done it again, then you have again the desire to do it. So you have two plus. You have two positives plus that plus of the desire, so it just keeps increasing. So with time, then that starts to become stable. So that's called nishtha. So the roller coaster ride is within control. So then it's like Krishna consciousness is the basic foundation, now and again it goes out. Like someone was telling me, there was a discussion between, I think it was a Kinchana Das Babaji Maharaj and some other devotee. And I forget who it was, either Bhakti Chumars was kind of like serving him at the time or something. Because he used to come here, Kinchana Das Babaji Maharaj, to spend a couple of weeks, and Bhakti Chumars would take care. I think this was in Vrindavan. And the one was saying that, you know, it's been very nice, and the one was saying about, in an hour, about 11 minutes, I'm always focused fully on Krishna, and the rest is like it goes, and I have to catch, bring back. The other one was saying, they were saying that, they've come to the point where 11 minutes is only the time that they're not Krishna conscious. You know, it's now it's 49 minutes of Krishna consciousness, and 11 minutes it goes out, and then they catch it. In other words, it's just a matter of how long can you find it and catch it. Because that's the thing, because once you notice it, then you catch it. But until you notice it, you don't catch it, it just runs because of habit. So that's the thing, is that by creating new habits, then you will catch where you lost the Krishna consciousness. And it's just old habit. You know, so that's the first stage. That's getting rid of the anarthas, the gross. Then the next stage is that now I'm doing the Krishna conscious good habit, but I'm doing it for some other purpose, just because my conditioned nature likes that, or the benefits I get from it, or you know, in whatever it is, in cash, kind, or you know, praise, acceptance, security, these kind of things. So then because those were subtler points on why you did the activity before. You did the activity because it would get you some gain or safety. Now I don't do that activity, I replace that with another, or now I do it for Krishna. But then that deep-rooted point is the desire for that gain and safety I would get from it. So now you have to then start catch that. In the beginning you'll catch that I'm not doing it for Krishna, I'm doing it for myself. Then you'll get it that I'm doing it for Krishna, but still, even though I've done it for Krishna, people are going to say it's good or I'm going to get facility for it. So that's the next thing, when you have to catch that. And then when you get that, then that's gone. You know, in that anartha that has been brought up to the... Then you're fixed in that. So you'll also find within certain things, certain elements, you may be on taste, certain things are attachment, certain things are nishta, you're fixed. Certain things you're still working with the anarthas. You know, certain elements you're still trying to get fixed like this. Though there'll be a major... Wherever the major is, that's called that section. Is that, that is, you know, like that? Like someone, like you'll find some complete madman, you know, like that. Complete nonsense. Everything they do is just completely passionate, mundane nonsense. But with that same passion, they come to the temple and take prasad with gusto and dance in the kirtan and love fired up kirtans and that. Then after the Sunday feast and kirtan, bang, you don't see them again. Or, a long time until they kind of like resurface, you know, from there. Just so they have a taste, they have an attachment, but it's only in that field. But it's not enough to keep them to make their Krishna consciousness stable. But it's enough to that they'll perform Krishna consciousness occasionally. So as that goes and they associate, then they'll come daily, then they'll come, and then they'll give up their nonsense, and then like that. Gradual process. So it's a matter of all engaging all these things at once. There is a general principle that you can basically fit what area, but then within that, then there's the finer points, you know, and then you look at that. And so depending upon one's, I say, analytical propensity, one will analyze to that degree. Because otherwise one will analyze something. You know, so one might as well be analyzing one's Krishna consciousness. You know, the technical aspects. Because then your analytical ability is engaged. If it's minor, one just looks at it for the moment, makes a decision, moves on. That's all that's necessary. If one constantly analyzes, then one gets more technical, more metaphysical. So, but the point is there is some intelligence there. You know it's for Krishna, we're not the body. And you know that this activity tends to be more classified as bodily, so it's not as good as this activity would be classified as Krishna conscious. So knowledge is there, discrimination. Like that. And then the more that intelligence, you know, from the conditioned nature, the more you apply it in that way. And the less you don't. If the emotions are more, then you have to see those emotions engaged in Krishna's service. But if someone's very emotional, they should try to put themselves in contact with someone they trust who can give some direction to the life. Because otherwise the emotions tend to distract you the most. Like that. If you run down that, it'll take you the farthest away from the middle before you catch. But because of its pendulum nature, then you'll swing back the other way. So that gives them greatest... The roller coaster comes from the mind. Because the other two, like ego, that one is very slow to give up. Like that, unless it's a really harsh reaction. Then you'll just adjust it to one thing, but you may not go to the opposite. You'll generally adjust to that point of where the pain is coming in. You know, like that. You know, if you're a slob and then somebody who's neat tells you you're a slob, then you'll adjust over to that. You know? Or if someone tells you, oh, you're such a fanatic, you're so clean and orderly and, you know, Ms. Perfect, Ms. This, then the tendency is to go over to, you know, reduce it. But if it's not so much, then you're going to take it more carefully. But it's still, it's the mind has to accept it, reject it, otherwise you're going to stick with it. And the intelligence will generally take it, you know, section by section, like that. You divided this into five sections, you're going to look at all of them. Intelligence-wise, will look, and then it'll say, this is better than this, this is better than this, this for this reason, that for that reason. Whether you do it, that's another, that's up to the mind. But at least by intelligence, it'll be more careful. Ignorance, because it's so heavy, it's more slow. It's like a big wave. It's very hard to move. But mind is flickering. So in a moment, what was so important to you, the next moment is like completely so socially unacceptable. You know, the outfit that everybody is wearing, the next day is like, you know, what? Just, that's the mind. So therefore you'll see people who are more emotional are generally more caught up in this, you know, like that. You know, you take someone like Einstein, who wasn't known as an emotional person. He had five exactly matching suits, had all the same elements. So it didn't matter. He put on the pants from this suit, the jacket from that suit, the tie from this suit. It didn't matter. Every day looked the same. He didn't have to worry about what am I going to look like today. He just went and put on a suit. If he dropped something on one pair of pants, he wore the pants from the next one. So it was just working. He didn't care. And everybody goofs on when you think of the the professor. Yeah, you always think of Einstein as that, you know, kind of, you know, shuffling around in his house slippers, you know, with his three-piece suit on, you know, and stuffing his hair all out like this, and, you know, it's just because he didn't care, because the emotion wasn't, the intellect was, so it's just fixed. But you find someone's very emotional just from one moment to the next, they have new clothes, new food, new place to stay, new associate, new effort, just has to constantly, you know, like that, because the mind, it basically needs external stimuli. The intelligence functions itself, and if it gets external, it will internalize it and take it more. You know? And if someone has that, then they can also then internalize emotions. They can, the two go together. So therefore you'll find many times very intellectual people can be very emotional. Like you see, like the Kshatriya, they're an example of that. Very intellectual and very emotional. Like that. Well, Brahmins will tend to be more intellectual, less emotional. Like that. Vaishnavas more emotional, less intellectual. Shudras, emotional, not intellectual. Like that. Though some of them are very intellectual. You know, like Salvador Dali or something. You know, something weird like that. Picasso, they got their philosophy. You know. But otherwise, not. But you'll see it's because they were really intelligent and the two, they go together. They're very good in their art, they're very good there. And if they're mediocre, it's mediocre. Okay. So that they balance each other. So it's just one has to look into all the application of all those things and just analyze what's actually going on? What aspect is functioning now? Is it the ego based on the gross elements, or is it the ego based on intelligence and senses, or is it ego based on the mind? Within that, the emotions, the values, right? Because they always have the higher and lower, you know. Your values, your emotions, or that you have the intellect, the senses. You have the subtle identity of who you are and your gross identity of the body, the bodily manifested through. So then, what's functioning? So So that way one can keep oneself, you know, one's conditioned nature happily engaged, you know, hour after hour, day in, day out. But you have to apply it, because that's Buddha Yoga. It has to be applied to an active situation. Because if it's not applied to an active situation, then it will become academic, and you won't get realization. You'll get knowledge, but you won't get realization. But if the knowledge is as applied in activity, then you get realization. That will change the value, because knowledge doesn't change value. It puts a doubt in it, but it doesn't change it. It opens the door, but it doesn't change it. Realization changes value. So realization only comes in relationship to activity. So when knowledge and activity are combined, like that, contemplation and application are combined, you get realization. That changes value. So that's the key to that aspect.
That changes your identity.
Yeah, so then that will ultimately change your identity. Then it changes the consciousness. Because what you're trying to do is change the identity to the point where I am Krishna's servant and pleasing Him as my life is the all is your identity, but there's no other thing. You know, it means as a devotee, that is our identity, but we have so much baggage behind it that takes us away from that identity. You know, it's just like, okay, I'm a pilgrim. Right? If I have only one handbag, then the majority of my time is on pilgrimage. But if I'm taking along with me huge amounts of luggage and all that, a great amount of my time will be going into my luggage. Moving it, transporting it, keeping it safe, keeping your eye on it, getting it stashed here, getting it out again, getting it. So even though you are a pilgrim, your luggage takes up a lot of your, you know, time. But if you have nothing, then all you focus on is where you're going. All you have to think about where you're traveling is the next place, what you're going to see there, what you're going to do there, what you know, what the last place you were there, what benefits were there, what a nice place. That's all you know, because it takes 2 seconds to buy a ticket, to sit down, do this, that, because you have your bag, you don't have to worry about it. So that's the whole idea. You reduce all those things, you slowly, slowly bring it. The less baggage there is, then the more the consciousness becomes the prominent. So even though every devotee, I'm Krishna's service and pleasing Him, is the identity, because of the baggage of previous habit and desire and values, you get distracted into all these other things. Is that? Thank you. Can I ask for this? He's one of those intellectual phantasmagorians.
Sometimes you have to play some of the things that are not in mind, just to study.
Sometimes directed by a particular anartha.
Some tests.
The last word?
Some
example of a test. You should pass the exam. Some particular position is given to rectify us of a particular anartha. This situation comes again. Okay. Oh, means the test comes again and again. Yeah. Okay. So why does a particular test come again and again? Because the desires within the heart, are so deep. It has to be sure. Because it's just like this. If someone says that they're your friend, or this more intimate and they have affection for you, they've told you once, Is that enough? No. You again and again look and test and see. Right? And then once that's again and again seen and tested, that brings them to another level within within your heart, right? They're more intimate and more close because they've gone. Or test and test again and they don't, and then you put them into another category. Right? So, we're people. Right? God's a person. Just because we've gone in front of the altar and said, Krishna, I'm yours, and I just want to do everything for you, I want to give up all this material nonsense, this and that, that's good. Krishna will take that very seriously. But that has to be there when you drop your hands and you start walking somewhere else. And then someone bumps into you and, yeah, then you see where you're going, you nonsense. And, then it's kind of like, hey. Many times you'll see is what you prayed, sometimes even within your sentence, Krishna's already testing it. Like that. Thinking, yes, I only want to think of you and, wow. It's right there. Within the same sentence, you haven't even put the period yet. And it's already, Krishna's tested it. Like that. Very amazing. Krishna's a far-out person. And he does it so smoothly, that you don't even notice it. So, one is that, because, in other words, if it's coming again and again, you know that that was a very deep anartha. Because there is the level where you accept it intellectually to drop it, and the situation is such that the modes of nature were such it was easier to drop. Like that. Or there is the situation where the modes of nature made it where it would be harder to drop. So you have to check all those. You've decided today, I'm doing Nirjala Ekadasi. Okay. And you did it. It was a cloudy day, there was a storm, wind was blowing, you had to wear a chadar, it was so cold. Okay, you did it. Then you think, I'm over that, now I'm the great faster. Right? The next Nirjala Ekadasi comes along, it's boiling hot, there's no wind, it's muggy as anything and all that. Then we'll see. Right? Okay, you did it, because there was nothing around to drink anyway. You were so thirsty, there was nothing to drink. Next time, you made it. See, I'm doing great. Two times, Nirjala. Then the next time, Krishna may put the water right there in front of you. Or maybe the water is not the thing, but then he put something else that's more attractive. So then he has to check all the angles. Because the point is affection or love, it has no boundaries. It's not that I love you in this situation, but in that situation I don't. Right? That's an American thing. Right? Like that. We're great friends and this and that. I'll screw them like this for over a political managerial thing. And after that, we'll go back. We're best of friends. Right? That's for animals. But on the transcendental plan, love is across the board. You like the person no matter what. Aslishiva adartam vinashtama adarshanan marmatam karopava. You want to harass me, you want to make my life miserable, I still like you. Right? When the baby's going goo goo gaga and everything like that, eating when they want, going to sleep when they want, and then, of course, what mother won't like that kid? When they're wetting their diapers, they're crying, they got a rash, a bug's just bit them, they're teething, then you see who's the mother and who's not. Who's got the kid in daycare at 6 months and who doesn't? Right? You know what I'm saying? Then you see where's the affection. Right? That's the point. So, that has to be seen. Is that in this situation, okay, in the temple, you're dressed in your devotional clothes and everything and all that, and you're there in the Artik, and you have affection, you're manifesting it, and it's there, and you've proven it. And then when you go home and you take off and you put on your karmi clothes and put on your karmi music and get out your karmi food and sit down and read your karmi magazine, then? Yes? No? I'm not talking over there, I'm talking over there. Right? So that point is there. Then what is there. It's good, Krishna's happy, that much has been proven, but it's supposed to be 100%. Anything less than 100% doesn't satisfy 100%. And Krishna is the complete person. He's Purna, right? That's one of the names of the spiritual world is Purna. It's one of the names of Krishna is Purna. His Purna is complete. So we see the gopis have love for Krishna, but he'll do something to increase that love. He's called them. That increases their love. Then they come. Then he tells them, oh, nice night. Why don't you know? So now that you've seen around, go back now. You know, it's, that increases it. Then he starts a rasa dance. That increases it again. Then he disappears. That increases it again. Then he comes back. It increases it again. Because the whole point is, it's perfect. There's always more perfect. There's no limit to perfection. So whatever it is, Krishna's going to test and test again until that's it. Does you don't even notice. In other words, that you're still noticing it's a test means there's still the fragrance of that anartha is still there. Otherwise, you wouldn't notice it. Right? The discrimination to notice it means it's connected to that desire. Right? You know, as we mentioned, if someone who has fine taste in cooking will recognize good cooking. Someone who, it doesn't matter what you give them, right? The Shastra connects this person to a bull. A bull has no discrimination in taste of eating. Anything it just eats, it just eats. It doesn't matter. Cows make a distinction, bulls don't. So, therefore, they wouldn't notice that today they got nice food, tomorrow they got bad food. But if someone who has discrimination in taste, then they will see Krishna's tasting. You're attached to fine food, therefore Krishna is giving you not fine food. But when you don't notice that it's fine or not, you just notice that it's Bishad and Krishna's mercy, then you pass the test. So the grossest had passed, but the value system is still there. The fragrance is still lingering. Right? Like that. So that's the whole time. It may take time. But it means progression is there. When Jnana and Vairag are there, then you can see, you can tell that there's progress. That's how you tell there's progress. This devotees ask probably, how do you can tell there's progress? Because we don't have love, so we can't see that. It's Jnana and Vairag. Because that's automatic byproduct of bhakti. So when you have more understanding of it and less attachment to it, then you can understand in that field you're advancing. Right? And everybody's field is different because everybody has different anarthas. So it's not important that everybody advances in the same field. Our general points are general. I'm God, but that's a common field. Right? Like that. So, you know, that one you can talk to everyone on. You know, I'm spirit, soul instead of God. Okay, that's one thing everybody can hear. But other details then are depending upon the individual. So one person's anartha is the food, another is his clothes, another is his social status, another is his facility, another is his protection, another is money, you know, another is relations, another is, you know, everybody's got their anartha. And you can always tell it what it is by what they're always talking about. Right? So we just gave ourselves away. So, right? Like that. Someone's always talking about, you know, everyone in this community, you know, they don't interact nicely, they don't know how to take care of everybody and all that, because their anartha is that need to be taken care of and interact. So they're making the comment because many times because they do take care of others, right? Means four options are there in Amanita Manadena. One is I expect everybody to deal nicely with me, but I don't have to deal with everybody else because everybody else has to understand because I'm special. That's the lowest, right? Everybody will say that's bad. Then the next is, I don't care about being respected, but I don't respect anybody either. You know, like that. So, you know, out of my face, you know, like that. There was a guy in the barrel who was like that. Greek guy, one of the great kings, went to see Diomedes or someone like that. Huh? Alexander went to see this guy. So he lived in a barrel, I think, or kind of like that. He came, he said, oh, you're such a great saint, can I do something for you and all that? He says, can you move out of the sun? You're blocking the sun. He didn't want any respect. He didn't give any respect. Because, you know, so, you know, detached, elevated, but still socially, still a nerd. Like that. Then higher than that, then is, you respect everybody else, you do everything perfectly, but they better respect you, or they're in your bad books. And the highest then is, you respect everybody, and you don't worry if anybody respects you or not. That's detached. That's actually having given up any connection with the material world. Because you have nothing to gain. So it doesn't matter, they don't need to respect you. But it's etiquette, you respect everybody, because you see everybody as devotees. So that's the principle. So when you come to that, then it's another thing. Then you just see they do. They don't complain about it. No, unless it's complaining about the juniors that they have to teach, these good character and all that. But if it's a general thing, you know, no one in this community knows how to interact, no one socially interacts, no one drops over at your house, because that's valuable for them. And they may be doing it, so they expect others. Right? And some people, they expect others and they don't do it themselves. But the whole point is no, it's like if it's actually important, it's your conditioned nature, you do it. It doesn't matter if anybody else doesn't do it. Okay? Then when these tests come, it doesn't even matter. Then you know that particular attachment is gone, because now you'll still work within that field, but it's just used for Krishna. So there's no need of testing in that field. But as long as you're noticing it and it's an obstacle or it's a burden, then it means there's still some weight of that on that anarthas still there. Does that make sense? The meaning of today's festival. What is today's festival? It's today? It's tomorrow. So then we qualify that what Prabhupada says, the praise. I thought for sure that it was on Monday. The significance of the return wrath. For the Vrindavan Vasis is not so much significance. For the Dwarka Vasis is more significance. But at the same time there is rasa in the return wrath, so that is then seen. The Roth festival itself is the significance is the Lord is the taste of separation in union. Is that you're with the person, but you can't interact with the person. It's the most painful of all the forms of separation, so it's the highest. So that being tasted is that they're taking Krishna and Balaram and Subhadra back to Vrindavan, where the devotees can, Vrijabhasis can interact. The return rap then is the element of then of being appreciating the, though it's rarely manifested, the man of Lakshmi, like that. She gets angry because Krishna's gone off with these other gopis and she's not with her because he's married to her. He's not married to those gopis. So that he's gone to Vrindavan and he's hanging out with other girls, that doesn't please her. So then she becomes angry. And then they have this festival at Hira Panchami where she comes with her servants and says all kinds of arrogant things and shows her opulence, and her servants come and eat Jagannath's servants, and then he comes back, you know, because now he's, you know, worried, so he comes back to his place and she locks the door, can't come in, right? So he's got to spend the night outside like that, and so then he doesn't know what to do. I'm not sure if someone comes up with the idea or how it works out, but then he puts on his gold outfit, opulence, so now he's going to win her over. She's opulent, she's displaying her opulence, so to go into that kind of, to commiserate with that movement at the same time, lighten it, then he's very pleasant, but at the same time he shows equal and more opulent as she is. So then that creates a commonality between them, so then she can be attracted, and then she opens the door and lets him in. You know, so even in Vaikuntha it's tough. So no one should be under illusion that it's going to work out smoothly here. Yes. Saying another aspect that she finds, you know, that she contemplates and, you know, gets a nice inspiration from is that Krishna may be leaving Vrindavan, going back to Dwarka, but that's for the purpose of establishing Krishna consciousness. You know, the preaching and, you know, the battle of Kurukshetra and what do you call it? The speaking Gita, you know, so that then the devotees can then take up Krishna consciousness. So Lord Chaitanya is going with that. So then it's also the element of the preaching. So the Sambandha element is, you know, enhanced in there. While the Avideya and Prayojana is enhanced in the going up, the main one. Because Madan Mohan attracting others, then that's the Sankirtan movement. Like that. Well, then the association, you know, with devotees, and that's the Govinda, as he discussed the uniform qualities, pastimes, this and that. And then Gopinath is the taste, what derives from that. Saying that, and it happens every year, so you can embellish it every year. If he didn't come back, then he wouldn't be able to go again. Like that. So then each one nourishes the other. Like that. Anything else? At least we ended on a sweeter note. After crossing the dry desert, Srila Prabhupada had a key. Vrindaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Samavita Bhakti Vrinda ki. Jainata Gopura Prevenanti ki.
What if it had ended with sweet rather than a stringent